Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Madison McVann, a reporter with the Minnesota Reformer, an independent nonprofit news outlet, who discusses her state's residents' courageous and resilient response to the escalating Trump ICE wave of state violence. Mel Goodman, a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and former CIA analyst, who assesses the worldwide revolt against Donald Trump's irrational, deadly foreign and domestic policy. And Eddie Lejeune, a commercial fisherman from Cameron, Louisiana, who talks about the fossil fuel industry's building frenzy in his community and along the Gulf Coast that's made this region a toxic sacrifice zone. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
15 years after the Fukushima disaster, Japan is reopening nuclear power reactors amid rising anxiety. The owners of the massive Kashiwazaki complex, northwest of Tokyo, is moving to restart one of its 7 reactors. The nuclear complex, located on the shores of the Sea of Japan, is the largest in the world and sits atop dangerous seismic faults. A 6.8 magnitude offshore earthquake in July 2007 ignited a transformer fire and shut down 3 of the site's reactors. There's a great deal of public mistrust of the plant's owner, TEPCO, the same utility that operated Fukushima before the 2011 tsunami led to the world's worst nuclear accident since Chernobyl. Local authorities ignored demands for a regional referendum to determine the plant's future. But a poll conducted last year found that more than 60% of people living within 30 kilometers of the plant said they did not believe the conditions for restarting the facility had been met. The Trump administration's Department of Justice is making an unprecedented demand of states to turn over official voter lists with no legal justification. Voter data carries sensitive personal information on tens of millions of Americans. The Justice Department requested 43 states to turn over this data, which includes the last 4 digits of Social Security numbers, dates of birth, and current addresses. After only 8 states complied with the voter data request, the DOJ filed lawsuits seeking the material against 23 Democratic Party-led states and the District of Columbia. In refusing to turn over the voter files, election officials cite state privacy laws. Over the last decade, Donald Trump and the Republican Party have advocated for the adoption of dozens of voter suppression laws targeting people of color, students, and other Democratic Party constituencies, claiming without any evidence that massive voter fraud is being committed by undocumented immigrants. David Becker, the executive director for the Center for Election Innovation and Research, asserts that this push for voter data collection appears to be more focused on amplifying false narratives about problems with our election system and preparation for elections that candidates aligned with President Trump might lose. As football fans gear up for this year's overhyped Super Bowl extravaganza, concern is growing among states and municipalities about the huge cost of taxpayer subsidies given to underwrite new sports stadiums for teams owned by multi-billionaires. In December, the Kansas State Legislature and governor agreed to fund 60% of a new stadium for the Kansas City Chiefs, committing to spend up to $1.8 billion, the largest ever pro sports team subsidy. In September, Washington, D.C.'s City Council approved over $1 billion to move the Washington Commanders from a Maryland suburb to a new stadium in the nation's capital, a deal that will cost the district up to $25 billion in revenue over time. These deals come at a time when cities and states are struggling to provide basic services for their residents. New stadium projects are also under discussion in Chicago, Denver, and Newark, New Jersey, where wealthy team owners are pushing to win huge taxpayer subsidies. Neil DeMouse, a journalist who's written extensively about stadium subsidies, says, "We're in a moment where team owners feel entitled to demand a lot more billions of dollars than anybody else has, and the more they get away with that, the more their fellow owners are going to be emboldened to ask for the same thing." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
A second Minneapolis resident was killed by ICE agents on January 24th, just one day after a general strike was called in the city to protest the January 7th fatal shooting of Renee Good and weeks of brutal ICE abductions targeting non-citizens and citizens alike. Just hours after ICE agents shot 37-year-old Veterans Administration ICU nurse Alex Pretty 10 times, Trump regime officials falsely labeled him a domestic terrorist intent on killing federal officers, repeating the same lies with which they attempted to criminalize and demonize Renee Good. One week after Trump ordered the Department of Justice to open investigations on Minnesota Governor Tim Walz and Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey, alleging they obstructed ICE operations, both men had phone conversations with the president described as positive. The White House announced on January 26th that Border Patrol Supervisor Greg Bovino was relieved of his command of immigration enforcement operations in Minnesota and that an unspecified number of his agents would also soon leave the state. That same day, a federal court judge in Minneapolis heard arguments from Minnesota officials seeking to end what they called an unlawful and unchecked invasion by some 3,000 federal agents in violation of state sovereignty under the 10th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. A recent letter from Trump's Attorney General Pam Bondi to Governor Walz had demanded the state turn over voter registration records, welfare program data, and repeal sanctuary policies in exchange for reducing or ending federal immigration operations in the state. Your reporter spoke with Madison McFan, a reporter with the Minnesota Reformer, an independent nonprofit news outlet, who talks about her state's residents' courageous response to the escalating wave of Trump ICE state violence.
The Bureau of Criminal Apprehensions here in Minnesota investigates most law enforcement involved shootings, and so that would cover shootings by federal agents as well. So while they were able to access the scene of Renee Good's killing, the FBI and DHS took the evidence with them and have since blocked BCA from accessing evidence like the car that she was killed in. When it came to the killing of Alex Pretty, they didn't even let BCA investigators on the scene. So the BCA showed up, you know, like they normally do to go check out the scene and gather evidence. And, you know, the federal agents blocked them. So then they went to a court and got a warrant to access a public street, which is a really unusual move. Came back with the warrant and the federal officials still did not let them access the scene. So the state's being totally shut out of this. It seems like even some Republicans in Congress are showing some kind of interest in investigating the killing of Alex Pretty, but I'll kind of believe it when I see it. It seems like the DHS is more interested in investigating itself.
Madison, I did want to ask you about this violence here we've seen. With two people killed in the streets by ICE agents over the last several weeks, has the threat of violence from ICE been at all a damper on the protest movement? Have people expressed fear that being out in the streets with their whistles and protest signs against ICE agents that are conducting their operations is inherently dangerous? And again, has this really had an impact on the ability of protesters to get out in the street and make their voices heard?
I would say that it has increased people's fear, but it has not dampened protests. You know, people are scared, but I think they're also feeling like they're backed into a corner and they're fighting back in ways that I've never seen before. You know, it feels like in the Twin Cities, at least, which are, you know, these are deep blue, like extremely liberal leftist places. And there was kind of the groundwork formed for community organization during 2020 and George Floyd that is kind of being brought back up to the surface now. And we're just seeing widespread organization and participation. And I think one of the things that makes people feel safe is the idea of safety in numbers. You know, protesters know that ICE can find out who they are. They know the government can track their license plate or look up their name or use AI to scan their faces and find their identities. They all know this. So they're under no misconception that they can keep their anonymity. They just think if we all keep showing up, then we're all going to be safe. So we're seeing that play out in lots of ways in the Twin Cities right now.
There are many people who are observers of what's going on in Minnesota with this ramping up of the ICE raids and the thousands of agents that have been deployed there. And they see this as a test case that if Trump can employ violent repression in Minnesota without accountability, then we could soon see what's happening in Minnesota be exported by Trump to all 50 states. As someone on the ground there in Minnesota, do you think that's a valid point of view in terms of we may be at a pivot point in our country, in our democracy, with these tactics, these violent tactics that are being deliberately targeted on Minnesota?
I would say it certainly feels like a pivot point. I mean, it feels like we've reached a new level of violence and state repression here in Minnesota. But I wouldn't declare this a Trump victory and say that this tactic will work elsewhere, because I'm not sure it's worked in Minnesota. I mean, like I just said, this has inspired so much collaboration and pushback amongst the general public that I just don't know if they'd have the manpower to do this across the country. Even here, it doesn't feel like they have the manpower. They're certainly getting their arrests. You know, they're still arresting immigrants. And, you know, two people have died so far. And actually, I don't think I've heard you mention yet, a third man was shot last week. He wasn't killed. But, you know, I don't know if it's necessarily a win yet.
Madison, I did want to ask you about the Minnesota National Guard that Governor Walz had activated. There's been some commentary about fear of confrontation between federal immigration agents and the state National Guard if they are deployed in the same place for different purposes. What, if anything, can you tell us about that?
Well, so far, the deployment of the National Guard seems to not have been an escalation like many thought it might be. I mean, they basically showed up. The reason that the National Guard was requested by Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey was that he was basically just saying, look, our police resources are stretched thin because of everything that's been happening. We just need more support on the ground. So the National Guard really just came out to the neighborhood where Alex Pretty was killed on Saturday. They instituted a curfew, and the National Guard was basically just in charge of making sure everything stayed quiet in the neighborhood in the days following Alex Pretty's killing by an immigration officer. But, you know, we also saw National Guard go out to the Whipple Building, which is the headquarters of ICE in Minnesota. And there's been kind of a standing protest there for a couple of months now. But the National Guard went out and started handing out coffee and hot chocolate and donuts to protesters. Mm. So I think that, you know, they're kind of walking this line of trying to be a de-escalating force rather than trying to escalate with either ICE or the protesters.
That was Madison McVann, a reporter with the Minnesota Reformer, an independent nonprofit news outlet. Find more news and analysis about escalating ICE violence in Minnesota and nationwide by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. As Donald Trump began his second year back in the White House, his erratic and irrational policies appear deliberately designed to destabilize the U.S. and the world. Over the last year, the twice-impeached U.S. president imposed and rescinded dozens of punitive tariffs, ordered the lawless bombing of 37 small unarmed boats in the Caribbean and Pacific, killing more than 125 people, accused without evidence of being narco-terrorists. Then early in the new year, He launched a military attack on Venezuela, kidnapping the nation's president, with the goal of taking over their oil industry. Perhaps most alarming was Trump's demand that Denmark cede control of Greenland to the U.S., with threats of military action later dropped that would have broken up the 75-year-old NATO alliance. In the U.S., Trump and the Republican Party have deployed U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents nationwide to conduct a brutal and repressive mass deportation campaign that has thus far resulted in 38 deaths in custody and 30 ICE shooting incidents in which 8 people have been killed. In January alone, ICE agents shot 3 people in Minnesota, killing U.S. citizens Renee Good and Alex Preddy, whom the administration falsely labeled as domestic terrorists. Public opinion polls find that Trump is the most unpopular second-term president in modern U.S. history, with nearly 60% of Americans disapproving of his administration's overall performance. Your reporter spoke with Mel Goodman, a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and former CIA analyst, who assesses Trump's irrational and authoritarian second-term foreign and domestic policies, discussed in his recent column titled, Donald Trump, Poster Child for Megalomania.
I've been saying for a long time, going back to the first term, that Donald Trump isn't compos mentis. He's a serious pathological narcissist. He's paranoid. His decision-making is questionable on every level. And what you see to me in terms of this disorderly nature of his decision-making is an unraveling of his policy, an unraveling of his administration, and an unraveling of his mind. So when you look at the current international situation, he's challenged that and created an unraveling in which Europeans have no idea what U.S. policy is. Various European diplomats have been quoted as saying there's no one they can talk to. The State Department doesn't function as a cabinet or administrative entity. There's no strategic policy making that's going on. And when I look at what's happening in Minnesota, frankly, in some ways this scares me the most, because when you look at the Department of Homeland Security, that seems to be functioning as a Ministry of the Interior. And we know authoritarian regimes always create a Ministry of Interior. When you think of what the Soviet Union did over the years, or East Germany did over the years, or the MUP in Serbia, designed to suppress dissent. So when you look at ICE, you've got the DHS police force that's very reminiscent of the brown shirts of various authoritarian entities. And then you add to that the Customs and Border Police and the Secret Service, for that matter. The DHS, or Department of Homeland Security, really functions at that Ministry of Interior. And then when you observe Trump in the last few months, there's such a disorderly nature to his comments. He was talking about Greenland, and about 4 or 5 times he referred to Iceland. And I don't know if he knows the difference. The pressure on the Norwegian government, which has nothing to do with the granting of Nobel Prizes, that's a special committee run by elite citizens of Norway, and then forcing the Venezuelan opposition leader to basically turn over her Nobel Prize, which Trump sorely sought. Now, why would you give a Nobel Prize to someone who's used force in the way he has, in a very erratic fashion? The fact that Trump wants to rename the Secretary of War, and the Defense Department, the Department of War, tells you that he's interested in fear, he's interested in authority, and his mindset, to the extent that there is a mindset, is incredibly dangerous. There's a lot to worry about here.
Well said, Mel. You know, one thing that you mentioned a moment ago that I think is true here, if there is any objective to Trump's policies, it's to keep the American people in a constant state of anxiety and fear. What would be the purpose of that if it's intentional? And it does seem it is.
Oh, I think it's intentional. And in one of the pieces I wrote, I think about the megalomania, and I think he's a megalomaniac, What's really frightening is there is no government. Goes back to the European diplomats who I talked about, saying they have no one to talk to. There are no assistant secretaries of any influence within the State Department. So what you then look for is who is running this government? I don't think it's Donald Trump, but you do see the role of Stephen Miller, who's a serious threat to our democracy, and has made that clear with his emphasis on the use of force. And then you have Russ Vogt in the White House, who I think is dictating domestic policy and economic policy to a great extent. So we have this facade of a government. You have this disorderly president with his disorderly mind making decisions and then reversing himself and then contradicting himself and never being able to really explain himself. So there's a lot to be concerned about.
That was Mel Goodman, a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy, former CIA analyst, and national security columnist with Counterpunch.org. Find links to his recent columns and related news and commentary by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Under the Trump administration's push for U.S. energy dominance, albeit policies that excludes renewable sources like wind and solar, there's a fossil fuel building frenzy along the Louisiana and Texas Gulf Coast, where construction of 6 liquefied natural gas or LNG export terminals are now underway or planned. That's in addition to 6 terminals currently operating. America's export of so much methane gas is increasing the price of the commodity for heating, cooling, and electricity across the country and burdening small communities in Louisiana and Texas with increasing levels of toxic pollution. The production of liquefied natural gas is also releasing huge amounts of climate heating gases into the atmosphere. LNG or methane is 100 times more powerful as a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide in the short term, making its reduction urgent. The company Commonwealth LNG is planning to build an export terminal near Cameron, Louisiana. The project was paused in October by a state judge due to concerns about climate and environmental justice impacts, but her decision was later overridden by Louisiana's Republican Governor Jeff Landry. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Eddie Lejeune, a fisherman from Cameron, who talks about all the fossil fuel projects now under development in his community and what fisher folk and their supporters are doing to fight back.
They killed the permit. The judge killed that. My understanding is it went back to state and they've rescheduled it to start back. The governor, Landry, has overruled our judge and allowing it to continue to go forth. They're also putting in a carbon capture pipeline about 6 miles from my house. And that's going to put a bunch of contaminants 2,000 foot into the ground below our aquifer and pump it with all the state up north and stuff with all their contaminants is going to go below our water system right not far from my house. The people do not want that. Somehow they pushed it in this area and it's going to be done. It's being done as we speak. There's leakage possible anywhere, but when they put it through this area into the ground, there's been thousands of oil wells have been drilled throughout the 100 years now. So we're like a pincushion in this area. The people are scared that when they push through our water aquifer and get below it, they're going to be pumping with such force. It's the stuff they're going to be putting is really bad contaminants, and it's like a gel form. And when they put that through there, we feel like it's going to find one of the old pipelines and either it's going to make our water acidly, kill our aquifer, or if it comes to the surface, you can't smell it, you smother to death. So we're facing that also with everything else that's going on with the Venture Global pumping up our marshes and stuff.
So the Venture Global, that's the CP2 project, and that's going forward also, right? The LNG export terminal.
And they're also building one to the north of the plant that we have about 2 miles from my house. They're building another one about a mile and a half north of it along the same waterway.
It seems to me that you're in a sacrifice zone. Would you agree?
Oh, most definitely. You see, we have about 3 miles away, we have the Strategic Oil Petroleum, the Salt Dome. So we have that. Now we're going to have the pipeline that's coming through with all these contaminants of carbon capture that the state has pushed on us. And with all these plants, they're building the fourth one, expanding the third one. We have one at Sabine, and then the one that the judge killed would be like the sixth one that they're putting in this little area. And as we speak, the mud that they pumped out into our estuary that they're still denying ever doing it.
So do you have anybody on your side? You know, the fishermen have gotten together, but do you have anybody who's on your side trying to fight these projects?
The police jury board. Well, we have one police chairman that's very concerned. The rest of them, they're for the industry. Some of the words that were said was sometimes they have to be sacrifices to make overall better for the parish.
Are there groups, you know, like local groups or Sierra Club? Is there any group like that that's in your corner?
Yes, we have the Sierra Club. You know, when I was up there in Washington, that's who was helping us there. There's the Bucket Brigade in the area, and then there's FISH, that's the little committee that we have going on, and Habitat Recovery. I've also, amongst a lot of the fishermen, have retained a lawyer now.
That was Eddie Lejeune, a fisherman from Cameron, Louisiana. Learn more about how the fossil fuel industry has impacted the lives of Americans in the Gulf South by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Blue Sky at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WPZW in Epsom, New Hampshire, WHYR in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, KKRN in Round Mountain, California, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.